If the theme of today's show is economic tensions with China, and it kind of is, well, that is by design. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Oakland, I'm Molly Wood, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Friday, August 7th, and we are so glad we all made it this far. We'll get to our weekly wrap in a moment, but first, some context, because that's our jam. Today, we got a decent but not great economic report to kick off the weekend. The Labor Department told us that employers kept bringing jobs back in July, 1.8 million overall. The unemployment rate fell about 1% to 10.2%. That's a little higher than the worst of the Great Recession, but certainly better than April's 15%. We asked Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman to look into which jobs are coming back and which might not.
If the job losses early in the pandemic were a torrent, 22 million jobs washed away in just about 6 weeks, the rebound since then has been more like a steady current, around 9 million jobs gained back. And the back-to-work flow's been strongest in low-wage service jobs that were savaged early on, says Julia Pollack at ZipRecruiter.
The largest gains were in leisure and hospitality and in retail.
Jobs stocking shelves at reopened stores, serving drinks at bars and restaurants, cleaning people's teeth at dentist's offices. But job gains slowed considerably in July compared to June.
And that's because as many cities and states had to pause their reopenings to fight back surges in COVID cases, businesses couldn't really resume business as usual.
The jobs recovery is doing better in sectors less affected by government COVID restrictions and consumers' caution, says Robert Frick at Navy Federal Credit Union.
Home construction and construction in general is doing well. Manufacturing is doing relatively well. A lot of those are important to the economy because it supports service jobs.
But Julia Pollack has a warning for professionals whose jobs depend on the consumer economy.
Among high-wage occupations where most workers can work from home that typically are recession-proof, we see stagnation and even continued decline.
In July, employers cut jobs in business management, advertising, computer systems, and commercial banking. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Okay, with all of that and a bunch of other news in mind, it's time to chew on the economic week that was. Heather Long is with the Washington Post. Gina Smilek is with the New York Times. Hi, you two.
Hi, Molly.
Hey, Molly.
So I'll start with you, Gina. In light of the jobs numbers, let's examine the state of a deal in Congress. There was another stalemate last night. And so the question might be, is this the kind of news that might, I don't know, push off a deal even farther?
I mean, I think that in many ways, this was the worst kind of a jobs report when it comes to negotiations over a fiscal deal, because it gave sort of everybody something to cling on to. You know, I think what we saw in this jobs report is a kind of lackluster number, but nevertheless a gain. And so if your presupposition is that the job market is coming back, you could use it to definitely feed into that narrative. At the same time, you saw, on a non-seasonally adjusted basis, you saw continued declines in state and local employment, not the kind of gains that we would necessarily be hoping for, given the massive scale of the decline and still millions of people on the sidelines. And so I think you can come at this from both sides here.
Well, and Heather, we still, as always, have to acknowledge this is a lagging indicator, right?
That's right. And those weekly jobless claims, we've had 20 weeks of over a million jobless claims, and that's an ongoing flashing sign. It looks like President Trump might try to pull the trigger over the weekend or even this evening on some sort of executive order. That's probably just going to throw even more chaos into this process, particularly if he tries to do anything like a payroll tax cut or extending unemployment benefits on his own. Obviously, a lot of people would like to see those benefits extended, but the power of the purse lies with Congress.
Right. Good segue, though, Heather. I understand that you did your first TikTok video last week. Do you or do you not feel responsible for the events of this week?
Well,
okay,
maybe
just kidding.
Just a little.
We're going to talk more about TikTok and WeChat in a minute, but I did see a headline from Lynette Lopez, an occasional rapper at Business Insider, and she said that in some ways, President Trump is trying to cram 4 years of China policy into 4 months. And I wonder, I'll start with you again, Heather, what are your thoughts on what we're seeing now with respect to business in China via executive order?
It's we went suddenly from Trump, the deal maker. He was talking only a few months ago about how great the deal with China was, to suddenly he can't stop talking about the China virus. And now he claims that two Chinese apps are huge threats to national security. That would be TikTok and WeChat, one of their messaging apps. So it's been quite a rapid change in President Trump's actions. And it's kind of hard to understand. You know, we're in the middle of a pandemic. We've got 30 million people who are on unemployment benefits. We've got small businesses that are in fear of closing. Why is TikTok and WeChat suddenly the biggest problems on President Trump's mind? Nobody understands that.
Gina, do you understand?
I'm just going to throw out a suggestion that I think the election could have something to do with it. I mean, I think the one thing we all know is that China bashing is good election year politics. You know, it does tend to play well. We've seen this attempt done before. I mean, I think that, you know, Lynette's piece actually made the point pretty clearly that, you know, some of what he's doing seems to be cramming in a lot of tough on China sort of rhetoric ahead of November. And so I think that is definitely one way to understand what is going on here.
And we have about 45 seconds left, Gina, but we also have these 10% aluminum tariffs on Canada and then now retaliatory tariffs going the other way. Is this also mostly politics? Is it voter-friendly protectionism?
You know, it's interesting because actually it seems to be at least partially a response to a partial industry lobby. A couple of big aluminum companies have been pushing for these tariffs on Canadian imports. The really interesting point about this is it's not actually industry-wide. Much of the aluminum industry is pretty interconnected with Canada. And per my colleague Anna Swanson's reporting, it's like very upset about these tariffs. And so it does seem to be partially catering to a portion of the industry, but not the whole thing. And so I think it's going to be really interesting to see how that plays out.
Gina Smilek is with the New York Times. Heather Long is with the Washington Post. You can see her latest TikTok on the Washington Post account. Thanks, you two.
Thank you.
Thank you.
On Wall Street today, nobody really likes it when trade tensions rise, even if voters do. That and the ongoing lack of progress on stimulus led to a down day. Details when we do the numbers. All right, more now on that executive order that President Trump issued yesterday, restricting the activities of Chinese social media apps, TikTok and WeChat. The order will go into effect in less than 45 days. And as we mentioned, the move dramatically escalates economic tensions with China and even makes it harder for some U.S. companies to do business in China, since WeChat is the dominant form of communication between these two countries. So here with us to discuss what this means for American and Chinese companies is our China correspondent, Jennifer Pak. She joins us from Shanghai. Jennifer, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Molly.
So give us a sense of how important WeChat specifically is as a tool for communication, but also for business.
Well, in my life, it's something I use every day. We call it the Swiss Army Knife app. I can't lay claim to that, but basically it does everything. So I book taxis through it. I split bills with my friends. I communicate with my colleague. I have to send files to people, videos, pictures. Everything is done on WeChat. It's the app of everything. So it's very important. And WeChat has a lot of functions, like if shops want to sell things, or if they want to advertise, when they want to communicate with consumers. Because remember, email is not widely used here. It's seen as really ancient. So for people who want to access the Chinese market, WeChat is it.
Let's broaden out a little bit because, of course, this Trump policy is an escalation that we expect to continue. What kind of chilling effect might this have on Chinese companies who are looking to expand into the United States?
Well, it's already making people not go to the U.S. for now, right? But we have to put this into context because the U.S. right now went from a very open landscape, level playing field for anyone wanting to come in and invest, to now having some policies targeting Chinese firms. But at the same time, if you look at China, China is opening up, but there's still many, many, many areas that are blocked for U.S. companies. And that's part of the reason why the trade war started. So it's hard to kind of compare what's been happening, but certainly TikTok has been very vocal about it's been very unfair. They have been trying very hard to play by America's rules, but they said that actually this has nothing to do with law. It has nothing to do with the national security concerns and everything to do with just trying to shut TikTok out.
So if this playing field, this very open investment playing field continues to narrow and Chinese companies don't want to invest or cannot invest in American interests, where might that money go?
It's already going to Southeast Asia. It's going to developing markets. Because remember, a lot of times when people talk about this conflict between the U.S. and China, it's really not about China-U.S. markets. It's really about the next 4 billion customers. It's about developing countries. So we're seeing a lot of the battles with e-commerce especially, Alibaba and Tencent coming face-to-face with Google and Facebook in Southeast Asia, in India, in Africa. So really, the tension is going to be about the competition that American companies will face when they go abroad.
Jennifer Pack is Marketplace's China correspondent. Jennifer, thanks so much for the time.
Thanks for having me.
Now to another story that's been bubbling along all week. Kodak is back in the news after an unusual turn of events. Last week, the federal government called on Kodak to help produce pharmaceuticals related to COVID-19 treatment. It was a new twist for a company that's already had several, from the premier photography company in America to bankruptcy in 2012 to this loan under the Defense Production Act that's now under congressional inquiry, to produce generic medicines that right now we mostly only get from China. Oh yeah, there's a China angle. And there's some questionable stock sales in there too. But we are going to try to answer the simplest question we can. Why Kodak? Marketplace's Jasmine Garst tackles that one.
Until about 10 days ago, Kodak's place as a household name was going the way BlackBerry and Blockbuster did. Then the Trump administration announced it's giving Kodak a $765 million loan to produce chemical ingredients for COVID-19 treatments. Professor Rosabeth Moss-Cantor from Harvard Business School says it's not as weird as it might sound.
Photography, I think, when it was invented, was all about chemical baths. So Kodak had chemical roots.
But many are raising eyebrows, like medical chemist and science writer Derek Lowe, who's suspicious of what's being heralded as Kodak's big comeback. He says the company will have to compete with a global and possibly cheaper supply chain.
Production for generic drugs is not exactly a path to riches. They are going to be hard-pressed to produce a lot of these things at any kind of price that can compete with what we get now from offshore supply.
It's hard to imagine this in the age of the selfie, but photography used to be something for special occasions and important people. Kodak became a household name because it made photography accessible to everyone.
Kodak's got the instant camera you've been waiting for. Instant color photographs, that's what the handle's for.
Professor Kamal Munir at the University of Cambridge has studied Kodak. He says it didn't just sell photography, Kodak was photography.
In their heyday, they had close to, sort of 70% of the global market share of film.
And Kodak's failure to adapt to the smartphone era made it a relic. But will the pandemic change that? Some are having a hard time picturing it. I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
Marketplace is producing a new special series called The Economy, What Now? Marketplace Morning Report is covering the big ideas that could help us emerge from this crisis with a stronger and more inclusive economy. Because even before the pandemic, the economy was not working for a lot of people.
I do not want to restart the economy that we had. It was a consciousness capitalism that in no way recognized the harm that inequality does.
Marketplace Morning Report will explore these and more ideas in The Economy Reimagined. You can hear it on public radio stations and online at marketplace.org. Coming up,
my brother being annoying, my parents being like impatient and like super strict.
The usual family stuff, except add a pandemic. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 46 points, a tenth of a percent, to close at 27,433. The NASDAQ was off 97 points, a tenth of a percent, to end at 11,010. And the S&P 500 was up 2 points, less than a tenth percent, to end at 3,351. For the week, though, the Dow added 3.8%, the NASDAQ grew 2.4%, and the S&P 500 also improved 2.4%. Some real-life numbers for you. Coronavirus disruptions to grocery supplies may have eased, but NBC News is reporting that retail prices for some goods are still higher than before the pandemic. Price increases were driven by a complex algorithm that included increased labor costs and other factors. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. In some places, there's a pandemic on and people are staying home. In Sturgis, South Dakota, there's the annual Sturgis Motorcycle Rally. A quarter of a million people are expected to roll through the tiny town over the next 10 days. Normally, Sturgis is home to about 7,000 people. So you can imagine how important this event is economically to the small town on the edge of the Black Hills. You can also imagine how not everyone is thrilled about packing so many people into that town as the coronavirus is raging. Marketplace's Andy Euler caught up with city officials and riders about what they're expecting.
The Sturgis Biker Rally is scaled back in its 80th year. No parades, no contests. The town city manager, Daniel Ainsley, says if fewer people show up, that's a hit for sales tax revenue.
If you look at what the city nets from an average rally, anywhere from $1 to $1.5 million.
That's 11% of what the city spends on roads, police, fire. Then there's the impact to businesses, not just in Sturgis, but all those that benefit from bikers on their way to the rally, businesses that are already suffering because of COVID-19.
The thought of not having the rally would truly mean that they would end up closing.
The rally annually injects some $800 million into South Dakota's economy, but still plenty of residents are worried about getting sick. Brenda Genovi is a registered nurse in the area who raised her concerns at a city council meeting in June. She said even in a normal year, the rally crowds area hospitals.
We do not have the medical beds, staff, etc. that we need to deal with traumas and COVIDs at the same time.
The event normally draws around 500,000 people. While crowds may be smaller this year, the mayor has said there's nothing he can do to prevent people from coming. Kim Lyshevska is a Sturgis bartender.
A lot of us rent out our houses, rent out our yards, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, the people who come and stay have already, you know, have said, yeah, we're coming.
Sturgis officials say they will conduct mass coronavirus testing after the rally ends on August 16th to learn whether all those bikers brought new cases of COVID-19 to town. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Now back to the pandemic where people are staying at home. For parents who are juggling work and childcare, it can be a lot. And not just for parents, for everyone in the family. Being together 24/7 requires a lot more negotiating and compromising. Rima Kreis is the host of Marketplace's podcast, This is Uncomfortable. She's got the story of one family that's relying on a pretty creative solution to help manage the chaos.
For months now, 11-year-old Joaquin Andrade has been quarantining at home with his family. And recently, to help blow off steam, he picked up a new hobby.
I just started biking way more, suddenly. It felt refreshing because sometimes I was just so fed up of what was happening in my house.
Like what kind of stuff?
Like my brother being annoying, my parents being impatient and super strict.
Biking became like an escape into another world, a world far away from online school and chores and parents constantly in Zoom work meetings. He got so into it that he started researching BMX bikes so he could go off-roading. And he found this one dark green bike that just looked really cool, but it was $300.
I said, I really like this one. And my dad said, okay, you're going to have to work for it. So we made a deal.
Where Joaquin saw adventure, his dad saw opportunity. Because this family, they actually have a whole system to bribe each other whenever someone wants something. And lately, it's been working really well for them. With the whole family, Joaquin, his parents, and his little brother home all the time, there's a lot more to compromise on. But they actually came up with this system years ago.
It really started when me and my dad had a few fights about what we agreed to.
For example, Joaquin would agree to get good grades in exchange for, say, a new video game. But then when it came down to it, he and his dad would remember the details of the deal differently. So after one argument too many, the family started negotiating these formal contracts and writing everything down. And the parents do it too. My personal favorite is when Joaquin's dad wanted to buy new car parts, he agreed in exchange to go on the scariest ride in Disney World, Tower of Terror.
It feels official because my parents actually use their real signature.
Do you have a signature?
I just write my name in cursive and then put my soccer number.
Joaquin's bike negotiations started off easy. Get up early and watch his little brother? Sure. Take out the trash, empty the cat litter box, and keep the playroom clean? Worth it for a bike. But then came the real stakes. Joaquin's taking these math classes over the summer, and his dad told him he'd have to get 97% or higher on every single assignment. So Joaquin presented a counteroffer.
I didn't think that I could do that every single time. Mm-hmm. So I said, lower it by 5. And yeah.
And how did they respond when you said that?
They said, okay.
So this summer, Joaquin got to work, dragging trash cans, watching his little brother and doing math problem after math problem, telling himself,
this is for the bike. This is for the bike.
At one point, he struggled to keep his math grades up. So his mom, Autumn Andrade de Leon, made him enroll in an online help session. Because really, she sees the contracts as a way to help him become more independent and try new things.
And I just remember telling him, sometimes we all need help. And this was just an opportunity for him to practice that. And it didn't mean anything about the person that he was or his abilities.
And it worked. He bumped his grade up. He'd held up his end of the bargain. So just a few weeks ago, Joaquin's dad took him to the store to pick up the BMX.
When I saw it come out, it looked so cool.
Really?
The paint job looks super cool combined with the rest of the bike.
Nice.
It felt awesome.
Joaquin's mom, Autumn, says these contracts are a way to include their kids in decisions around money and rules. And right now, it's especially helpful.
Our home life is more peaceful.
Hmm.
The world is kind of raging outside, and as adults, we deal with that, but our kids don't need to.
Because she says by making things all formal and official, they're leveling the playing field. And most importantly, keeping the peace. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
I'm so happy for that little dude. You can get all the other episodes from Rima's podcast, This is Uncomfortable, and all our other podcasts wherever you download. This final note on the way out, there was real panic in the video game world last night after President Trump's order on WeChat. That's because WeChat's parent company, Tencent, owns or is invested in some of the biggest game studios in the U.S. It owns the makers of Fortnite and League of Legends. It's a part owner in the makers of Call of Duty, and that's not all. Tencent has stakes in Tesla, Reddit, Snap, Spotify, and Universal Music. The administration clarified that the executive order only meant to refer to WeChat, but let me just say, I read it, and there is a lot of wiggle room in there. And that is our show for today. Happy Friday, everyone. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fregali. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of news, and I'm Molly Wood. Don't worry, Kai is back on Monday. This is APM.